This is Donald Hussig with Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. Joining us today from Region 2 EPA in New York City is Dr. Mark Mattaloni. Dr. Mark Mattaloni's expertise is in the area of quantitative risk assessment. He will be speaking with us about PCBs and the umbrella group of chemicals that they are part of, the persistent organic pollutants. Good morning, Dr. Mattaloni.
Good morning. It's 1 o'clock now, so I'll maybe say good afternoon.
It is afternoon. So, tell us a little about your background, your academic background, and then your employment background.
Okay, sure. My bachelor degree is in pharmacy, which I received from Long Island University, and then I decided I really didn't want to be a retail pharmacist counting pills, so I then went to on to do graduate work at St. John's University in New York and received a master's degree in toxicology from St. John's and from there went on to study environmental public health at Columbia University, where I received my doctorate in public health and environmental health sciences. My dissertation topic actually had nothing to do with PCBs. It looked at the absorption and modeling of soil-borne lead in human subjects. My work experience, I would say I cut my teeth really as a clinical toxicologist employed at the New York City Poison Control Center, emphasizing occupational and environmental exposures. And at that point, it was a natural segue to come to the Environmental Protection Agency, which I did in 1991 and as a risk assessor, and I currently hold the title of Regional Risk Assessment Coordinator in the Office of the Regional Administrator. So that's my work. And I would just also add that I am certified by the American Board of Toxicology initially in 1992 and have been recertified every 5 years since. I'm a member of the Society of Toxicology, and I sit on a number of boards, most notably the Institutional Review Board for the New York City Health Department, which, if you're familiar with, IRBs are responsible for approving any research that involves human subjects that an institution may be conducting. I also sit on the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection's Science Advisory Board.
We certainly have a lot of positions that are very important in moving forward these scientific knowledge to address chemicals and exposures and disease risk. Can you just give me, how did you particularly get into this matter of the quantitative risk assessment? Was that something that you encountered first in graduate school, or were you trained more as a risk assessor once you joined EPA, or how did that go?
Hand in hand, I started taking coursework in quantitative risk assessment at Columbia and then performed a lot of it here at EPA.
Yep, okay. Let's get into now the more technical matters, the more detailed scientific matters of our interview here. Thanks for giving the listeners and me more of an understanding of, where you are at this moment. PCBs were used in a considerable number of products and applications over the course of several decades, beginning in the 1930s. And, say, for example, window caulking, it once contained PCBs, and the old fluorescent lighting fixtures manufactured during the PCB use era, they contained PCBs in these capacitors. So the result of those products being in an indoor facility, such as a school, the air inside buildings that have PCBs in the window caulking and in their fluorescent lights, that air is contaminated with a significant quantity of the PCBs in some cases. Now, the Environmental Protection Agency has been involved in addressing air quality issues at New York City schools where indoor air PCB contamination exists. What is the range of quantities of PCB exposure that students and teachers and other staff are receiving from breathing the air in these particular schools?
Okay, thank you for that question. Well, the true range would not be known unless every single room in the New York City public school system was repeatedly sampled. But that said, EPA's National Exposure Research Lab has conducted what I would describe as a combined monitoring and modeling study to address this issue. And I'm going to have to necessarily give a very long, erudite answer to this because it's a very technical program and process that they're engaged in. And as much as I would like to just quickly summarize it, I don't think I would be doing it proper justice.
But that is wise.
Excuse me?
That is wise. I think it's
a good
decision.
And first, let me just provide a little history. Back in January of 2010, the City of New York and the New York City School Construction Authority reached an agreement regarding the assessment and remediation of core-containing PCBs in public schools with the Region 2 EPA. And we call this a consent agreement and final order. So if you hear me referring henceforth to a CAFO, that's what I am now,
okay.
The acronym I'm now using. And the goal of this CAFO was to develop a citywide approach to assessing and managing core-containing PCBs in schools built between 1950 and 1978. And I'll speak more in a moment about the cork issue, per se. As a result of this agreement, New York City initiated a comprehensive pilot study during the summer of 2010 to evaluate the possible presence of PCB-containing cork and the preferred remedial actions in three schools with evaluations in two additional schools to be conducted in 2011, which they have since been conducted, but not as much characterization has been completed in the other two schools as the initial first three. Now, I want to emphasize the consent agreement initially focused on cork because early reports of PCB problems in schools centered on the disturbance of heavily contaminated cork and sealant materials during window replacement activities. And there are a number of studies that documented considerably high concentrations of PCBs in these corking materials. And that's where at least the initial focus was. But let me continue. So a remedial investigation plan was developed by the School Construction Authority and their consultants called the TRC engineers, describing the selection of the pilot study schools. I think it was, how should I say, perhaps politically correct. One was chosen from each of the five boroughs in New York City. Excuse me, I'll pause occasionally for a drink of water.
Well, that's good, you know.
So we had the selection of these schools, the approach for measuring PCBs in and around the schools, and the cork remediation approaches to be investigated. So we did pre-remediation samples of cork, indoor and outdoor air, indoor surface residues, soils, and these were collected in the elementary schools PS178, which is in the Bronx, PS199 in Manhattan, and PS309 in Brooklyn. Remedial remedies were instituted in each school, including a cork patch and repair, which took place in 178, a cork removal and replacement in PS199, and a cork encapsulation at PS309. Then post-remediation indoor and outdoor air samples and indoor surface residue samples were collected to evaluate the remedial effect of the PCB levels on the school environment. So again, I just want to emphasize that initially these remediations were all focused on cork, various types of remedial approaches from removal to a patch and repair to an encapsulation. So let me continue. But then analysis of both the pre- and post-remediation air samples showed levels of PCBs at some indoor locations were greater than public health levels recommended by the United States Environmental Protection Agency. And that had a lot to do with the development of those exposure guidelines. Several actions were subsequently taken at the three schools to investigate and reduce the elevated PCB concentrations in air. In the first step, a thorough cleaning was followed by a day of very high ventilation using multiple high-volume blowers, followed by collection of a set of additional air samples and intensive examination of materials that could potentially serve as additional sources of PCBs was conducted at the schools. As part of this effort, it was determined that PCB-containing fluorescent light ballasts were present throughout schools, PS 199 and 309, and in sections of PS 178. An additional set of air samples was collected at each school following removal of the PCB-containing light fixtures and after a period of ventilation. And we did find probably the most pronounced drop in PCB air indoor air concentrations occurred after the removal of the PCB-containing ballast. At this point, however, EPA Region 2 requested the assistance of our National Exposure Research Lab, mostly centered in Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, and part of our Office of Research and Development, for the purpose of characterizing potential exposures associated with environmental levels of PCBs measured in the three schools. Region 2 specifically requested application of our exposure research labs. This is a model. It's called SHEDS, and it stands for stochastic, which is another word for like a probabilistic approach, but stochastic human exposure and dose simulation model for estimating multimedia exposure pathways. So what we intended to do with this model was to look at all the different materials that PCB containing, see how they could contribute to indoor air levels, and then look at the human activity patterns in the schools and determine a measure of dose from inhalation, from possible incidental ingestion of contacting PCB residuals on surfaces, and then even looking at the potential for what we call transdermal absorption of any direct contact, skin contact with PCB-containing materials. So the SHEDS model combines environmental exposure data with human activity profiles to come up with a probability distribution of PCB absorbed doses through the relevant pathways.
Okay.
Estimated distributions of absorbed doses were developed for three main age groups, 6 through 10, 11 through 14, and 14 through 18. Representing different types of elementary, junior high school, and junior high school, really, it was the three groups. Estimates for the younger age group, 6 to 10, are the most relevant for the three elementary schools for which the PCB measurement data are available. Now, it is important to emphasize that there is not complete data to fully estimate all the uncertainties in the model dose and the exposure pathway contributions estimated in this model. Considerable uncertainties may result from limitations in school measurement data, model and exposure scenario assumptions, like exactly how much time a child spends in school each day.
Right.
We have pretty good information about that, but it's not without some uncertainty. And limiting information about some other parameters. For instance, one of the things that I think we need to get better research on is the actual fraction of PCBs that get absorbed in the lungs when they are inhaled. Interesting, despite this voluminous database on PCB toxicity, there is a relatively thin volume on how well PCBs are absorbed by the inhalation route.
Okay.
And perhaps that is historically resulting from the knowledge that most PCB exposure in the environment has traditionally come from diet, so it's more from an oral or gastrointestinal absorption is really the focus of most concern. But clearly, in the schools, we are looking at this significant inhalation pathway as well. Let me just summarize the results and conclusions of this modeling. And by the way, I would love to just hand it over to you right now, but it is still in draft form and undergoing the checks and balances, if you will, that all of our EPA documents and reports get before they are generally disseminated to the public. And
okay.
I do hope, though, that that is soon, and when it is, when it does go final, it will be available on our website. But I could just, at this point, discuss with you and also include this as, I guess, a disclaimer or proviso of sorts that the document still is technically in draft form. So please acknowledge that.
And so what is the name of the document that people will be looking for in the near future?
I might have to follow up with you. It will say something about the stochastic human exposure and dose simulation shed
okay.
model for PCBs in schools.
Okay.
I'm sure at some point if you Google that, you'll get to the appropriate place.
Right.
So first let me summarize two things. The school measurement data that was collected, and then some of the what's called the dose estimation parameters. So what we did find was a wide range of PCB concentrations were measured in cork, air, surface wipe, and soil samples in the three initial pilot schools, 178, 199, and 309. And that's what this report will go out with, just those three schools, because the other two schools, which were sampled this summer, one in Staten Island and one in Queens, it would just delay the release of the report. And it may come out in an addended form eventually with all five schools, but the initial report, I think, will be just of the first three.
Okay.
Average PCB levels in indoor air decreased at PS199 and PS309 following each stage of remediation, including cork remediation, increased ventilation, and removal of PCB-containing fluorescent ballast. The average PCB levels in indoor air were lower at PS178 than at the other two schools. They increased slightly, which seemed not anomalous, following cork remediation and cleaning, but decreased with removal of the PCB containing fluorescent light ballast. But the levels in 178 were never as high as the other two schools from the get-go. Building and room ventilation conditions were not well characterized in these schools. Ventilation conditions and temperature varied across sampling dates, and these variables likely impacted the indoor air PCB concentrations to an undefined extent. It may account for some of the observed differences between time points. Measurement data compiled across the three schools was judged to be adequate to support this SHED's modeling effort for pre-remediation, post-cork remediation, post-ventilation, and post-lighting fixture removal time points. Let me just go into some of the modeling conclusions.
Okay.
As described in detail in the report, there are uncertainties and limitations in modeling estimates for dose distributions and contributions of relative exposure pathways. But that said, using model input measurement data from the schools, distributions of estimated doses of total PCBs from the school environments were generated using the SHEDS model, again, for three age groups, the 6 to 10, 11 through 13, and the 14 through 14 to 18 year olds. And I do need to correct myself because earlier I said there wasn't a high school age, but in fact there is a 14 to 18 year old. So
yes.
I will make that correction to my earlier narrative. Distributions of estimated doses were generated separately for pre-remediation, post-cork remediation, post-ventilation cleaning, and then post-light fixture removal. Estimates of absorbed dose in this analysis include only those exposures resulting from indoor school environment. Distributions of dietary intake of PCBs and exposure to PCBs in non-school environments were not generated as part of this exercise. The estimated doses for the 6 to 10 year olds at the pre-remediation time point, the 50th percentile was 0.022 micrograms per kilogram per day. And the estimated doses decreased at each point from that estimated exposure level after each of the three post-remediation time points. Again, after cork removal, after ventilation cleaning, and after lighting fixture removal. The estimated dose after all three remedial objectives were obtained decreased to 0.007 micrograms per kilogram per day as the 50th percentile in that distribution. The predominant route of exposure all age groups was inhalation. It was estimated that on average over 90% of the dose would result from inhalation at the pre-remediation time point, and over 80% was from inhalation at the post lighting fixture removal time point.
Okay.
Limited sensitivity analysis showed that the estimated doses were only moderately sensitive to changes in assumptions about PCB concentrations in dust, but were more sensitive to assumptions regarding the absorbed fraction in the lung. And that's why I had alluded to earlier that I think we need to do more research understanding exactly how well PCBs are absorbed in the respiratory tract.
Okay. So in other words, there are some numbers that can be used to begin to describe the quantity of exposure, but they weren't actually measurements of the actual exposure of any people. It was modeled, and it was based upon some assumptions, and some of the relatively important parts of the assumptions, this matter of what fraction of the dose is actually absorbed from the air in the lungs into the body, that is still somewhat in question. So there is, truly a lot of remaining work to be done to fully understand how much exposure has taken place. Is that a good, kind of understanding of this?
Yes. In fact, the next point I was going to go through was just the limitations. The models can be useful tools for estimating human exposure to chemicals in the environment, but it's important to understand that the limitations and uncertainties associated with modeling, to understand those uncertainties. And just go through a little of each of those uncertainties. Some of the limitations and uncertainties associated with this particular exercise was, one, the levels of PCBs in school dust, and the interior dust samples were not collected as part of the New York City pilot study. However, previous wipe sampling after school cleaning were mostly non-detects, indicating that incidental ingestion and dermal contact with PCB-containing surface residues would likely be a minor exposure pathway.
Sure.
So while it was not a particular focus of this, we had reason to believe that the exposure from settled dust in schools that were being routinely cleaned would not be that significant. Building ventilation is a huge issue here. Air samples were collected at multiple locations, including classrooms, gymnasiums, cafeterias, transitional spaces, at several time points in the three schools under different conditions. air concentrations of indoor pollutants were strongly impacted by ventilation rates in the building or in a room. Ventilation rates are very difficult to measure in individual rooms in older buildings, and no ventilation data are available for the three New York City schools. New York City schools, subsequent to that, have been performing some what they call air exchange rates in various rooms in their buildings, but they were not part of this exercise.
Okay.
While the air PCB measurements certainly incorporated some level of variability in ventilation rates, it is not possible to quantitatively characterize the relationship between ventilation and exposure from these data. Another potential source or limitation is the dermal contact and non-dietary ingestion rates. Dermal contact rates with potentially contaminated surfaces were not evaluated in these schools. But as I pointed out earlier, there wasn't really much concern with residuals on the surfaces, so that is likely to have a very minimal impact on the model output. What we do think may have some greater impact, and it was determined through our sensitivity analysis, was again this issue that I brought up earlier about the lung absorption of PCBs, and very little information is available to determine the inhalation absorption of PCBs through the lungs. Thus, in these modeling exercises, a 70% absorption fraction was assumed, and we do a distribution. So we looked at a low value of 35% and a highest value of 100% with a central tendency value of 70% to model the absorption of PCB absorption through the respiratory tract. It's interesting. I just recently reviewed a paper from some researchers at the University of Iowa who were looking specifically at this issue of inhalation uptake of PCBs, and they were working with rats in inhalation chambers. And by their estimates, they were measuring about, at least in this rat model, about 80% absorption. So,
okay. You
know, the 70% is probably what I would call a pretty decent ballpark figure.
Right.
Again, we didn't consider the dermal absorption of PCBs, or though they are not particularly well absorbed through the skin, they can go through the skin. But we just again in this situation didn't think there was that much potential for coming in contact with PCB contaminants.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
The other issue for anyone who has dealt with PCBs, really, I would just put this under what's called an analytical one, and that is, PCBs are measured variously by what their commercial products, which are called, Monsanto, called Araclose, or through their various congeners. And I don't want to go into PCBs 101, but, polychlorinated biphenyls, and when, there can be many different substitutions, and in all there are 209 different potential congeners. So the measurements in the schools was made as total PCBs based on analysis as Araclore. So we did an Araclore analysis as opposed to what we would call a total congener analysis. And so that also represents a limitation. And last, but certainly not least, is the dietary. The SHED's modeling estimates in this work are limited to, again, the indoor inhalation, dermal, and non-dietary absorbed doses from the school environments. A more complete model assessment would include the important contribution from dietary sources as well as contributions from outdoor and residential exposures. However, the additional time would be needed to examine the extent of PCB dietary data, looking at things like the total dietary study from the FDA, as well as residential data to determine their suitability for for the distribution analysis that is necessary to incorporate into this SHEDS model. So let me conclude by saying that the factors discussed above, as well as other modeling as well as other model inputs, contribute to uncertainty in model exposures and dose estimates. The uncertainty around Shedd's dose estimate distributions could be better characterized given additional data and more effort. However, there is currently not enough information in the literature to fully characterize all the uncertainties of PCB doses to children resulting
yes.
from contacts in the school environment.
Okay.
Well, I think that ends a lengthy answer to not that long a question.
Well, it's a good answer. It's a very good answer. It makes it clear how complex this matter is. Now, you said early on in our interview, you said that it was basically the position of you as a scientist, and I'm supposing of the agency itself, the Environmental Protection Agency, that the exposures that were taking place, you know, there wouldn't have been all this work done if it were not the case that these exposures were significant. And when you use the word significant, I'm thinking that means that there is the likelihood of some significant contribution to overall disease risk from these exposures. Is that correct?
Well, significant contribution to what we think is an acceptable dose. I would not make the leap to say that this is a significant contribution to disease because
okay.
the dose response is pretty murky down in that lower
okay.
range of the dose, you know, of dose response.
So then let me just kind of like make sure that everybody's thinking about this in the correct manner then. The use of the word significant as far as the exposures that took place in these schools that had the PCB contaminating materials, the use of the word significant means that the contribution of that particular exposure, basically the respiratory exposure to the PCBs in the indoor air in these New York City schools, that contribution was a significant portion, a significant fraction of what would be considered to be a acceptable amount of dose.
Correct.
Okay. So in other words, they're getting kind of close with these exposures to not being an acceptable amount of dose.
At some point. That's why we developed
yes.
exposure guidelines for the school.
Exactly.
Above
okay.
that, we would say that we no longer have what we deem as an acceptable. And that's not to say it's a dose that would cause an effect. Actually, it's far from a dose that would cause an effect because the way we come up with the exposure guideline is to start with an effect level and then build in various uncertainty or safety factors so that we could say that, you know, exposure at this level and below we would believe to
right.
be without any appreciable risk of a deleterious adverse effect with an adequate margin of safety. So when you go above that exposure guideline, I think what you're in effect doing is chipping away at that margin of safety.
Exactly.
Yes.
So now let's you know, kind of expand this now to the exposures that take place beyond the school, like the dietary exposure, which it's, you know, well established dietary exposure is the biggest part of exposure, except in, you know, instances such as this, and then it's a little more in question, which will be the larger part of exposure. But then when you start thinking about this add-on, it just totally, you know, my understanding of exposure and disease outcome is that in most cases, it is the reasonable way to proceed with thinking about it. If you don't have any particular sharp amount of data to choose to think otherwise, that the dose is at least a matter of this additive exposure where you just add an exposure, you get more risk, and that it certainly comes from these various exposure routes. And there certainly are PCBs throughout the global environment, especially as contaminants of the food supply, the animal fat portion of the food supply. So when you're saying that the kids may well be getting close to, you know, close to an unacceptable dose just from breathing the air then in that particular place, then they certainly would be likely to be getting more than an acceptable dose if you add on the food supply contamination exposure, you know, on top of that dose they're getting to school. Is that reasonable to conclude?
Not really, because when we did the risk assessment, When I specifically did a risk assessment for PS199 initially, and then we came up with a more agency-wide generic approach, it subtracts the dietary contribution. So the exposure guideline that we have set for schools already assumes that children are going to be getting exposure from sources outside of the schools.
Okay.
So, but your point is taken that, you know, at some point, you know, for lack of more sophisticated analysis, we just it does become additive. So you don't want to just look at any one exposure in isolation. You like to look at it as part of a total environment, and
okay.
We certainly are looking at it that way.
I was going to ask you what the impacts of PCB exposure are on health, but people can get that for themselves. You know, that's kind of a very kind of general subject area, and anybody can just do a Google search for PCB, comma disease, and they're going to know that diseases such as, well, cancer and some cognitive problems and various other health problems are associated with the PCB exposure in animal studies and more so in human studies. And it appears there's also involvement with cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, at least with, you know, all POPs, and many times it is the PCBs that are looked at the most closely. So let's kind of just
sounds like you're answering this question about.
Well, let's kind of just dispense that question. Okay. I've already answered it. So number, I want to talk now about a report.
I would just for the listener, I find and just is gauged at various different levels. Everything from the lay public to the most involved researcher and perhaps Donald, if I could call you that.
Yes.
You're familiar with this, but our sister agency, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, produces a whole line of what they call toxicological profiles on, you know, big sticker chemicals, and they have one for PCBs, and they're voluminous documents because they literally go through from soup to nuts everything that's known about the PCB. So for the listener that really wants to, as you said, learn every last detail about the potential health effects of PCBs, I would refer them to the ATSDR toxicity profile for PCBs. It actually, it's a little dated. It's from 2000. However, they did just release an addendum to that document, and which is dated April 2011. So it's quite current. And between the mother document from 2000 and the addendums from this year, I think the listener would be able to get just about every piece of relevant information on toxicity and health effects.
Okay. Speaking of documents, there's been a very powerful document published by the World Health Organization. The World Health Organization published Persistent Organic Pollutants, Impact on Child Health in 2010. This is a policy document, and it recommends that leaders in the health arena take action to minimize, and that's a very, very strong word, minimize the exposure children receive to persistent organic pollutants. Has the EPA integrated this recommendation into its work with populations that are receiving the respiratory exposures to PCBs? And, you know, you can answer that for, like, Superfund sites or schools or, you know, any places where EPA is involved with respiratory exposures to the PCBs.
Well, I would begin by conditioning the response to this question by noting that I'm a toxicologist in EPA's Region 2 office and not in the best position to pontificate on agency-wide policy regarding minimizing environmental exposure to persistent organic pollutants. However, that said, from a more regional perspective, EPA has worked closely with physicians at the Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit located at Mount Sinai Medical Center, which we fund, and also the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene to heighten awareness about potential PCB exposures in schools. In addition, Region 2 EPA has assisted our Office of Research and Development in development of a PCB exposure estimator tool, which utilizes a computerized database and spreadsheet to determine indoor air exposure guidelines for schools. This exposure estimator tool also gives consideration to the various other sources, most prominently diet, of PCB exposure. So I think we are not doing everything. We're doing the best we can here.
Okay. Let's talk about a little more of this then, a little more, can you just continue this thread here. Does the EPA, for example, you know, this is a very specific question about things that EPA could or maybe will do. Does the EPA provide education on this subject? And when I say, maybe I need to back up just a little so that listeners are understanding why I've started talking about the persistent organic pollutants, and that is because the PCBs are a very significant part of the chemical group referred to as persistent organic pollutants. And this group also includes, in addition to the PCBs, dioxins and brominated flame retardants, which have now become a big part of the indoor atmosphere, as well as the outdoor environment and the food supply contamination. But we're talking about a very large group of chemicals that have similar adverse health effects, and that it is very reasonable at this stage of knowledge to look at total exposure to all these chemicals when we're thinking about whether people are getting exposed at levels that impose unacceptable amounts of risk. So let me just ask you this question. Does the EPA provide education on the subject of persistent organic pollutants exposure minimization to children and school staff in the New York City schools where the respiratory exposure continues to take place at a lower level but has taken place for such a long time? And we need to make this point that the historic, you know, the earlier age exposures, they are relevant because these chemicals increase in body burden as the exposures take place throughout lifetime. If the answer to this question is yes, can you describe in detail the educational message that is being presented?
Well, first, you know, on the broader topic of persistent organic pollutants, EPA maintains a website on its what's called persistent bioaccumulative and toxic PBT, they call them, chemical program. And so we have various fish and wildlife consumption advisories that are included on this website. However, I would at least try to make a distinction here in that, you know, EPA's prime focus is reducing the amount of POPs, if you will, that are released into the environment and by extension then reducing the amount that can get accumulated, you know, into the food supply.
Right.
And that said, we not so much rely, but we fall back to our other federal sister agencies to take the lead on other significant sources of exposure, and most notably, as we started, I think we started this conversation, that diet is the primary source of PCB exposures in most people's environment, and ergo, you know, the Food and Drug Administration really takes a lead role on getting this messaging out to how to, you know, reduce, you know, the exposure to persistent organic pollutants.
Okay, so then maybe there isn't a specifically EPA educational message on minimizing exposure to POPs?
I think if you were to visit the website, and again, just you could just Google persistent bioaccumulative toxic chemicals, you'll see there's a wealth of data about persistent organic pollutants.
Yeah, see, I understand this. I know there's a wealth of data, but in the end, what is effective with educating the public is not a wealth of data. It's more or less like tight recommendations. This is the way public health has always, you know, been conducted, that there will be recommendations made by various expert agencies or entities, and even, you know, our small group, we're not a big organization, and yet we make recommendations. It's this matter of setting forth something that's like basically, don't do this to reduce your exposure. It's what you say, whether it's lead or, you know, arsenic or any other chemicals. It's always been this matter of the public health approach to give this basically a warning in the form of a recommendation that to reduce exposure, and then in this case to minimize exposure, not to do something. And in what we do, we publish health hazard advisories that describe this matter of the presence of the persistent organic pollutants in the global environment, and then the health problems associated with exposure, and then the way of minimizing the exposure and thereby minimizing the health risk be to not consume the animal fat.
Yeah, well, EPA, we have conducted regular information centers, information sessions, at schools throughout the city where PCBs have been found in cork and in the leaking lighting ballast, and where PCBs have been found in air, especially where they have been found, nearing or even on occasion above our exposure guidelines. And because individuals can be exposed to PCBs through a variety of ways, including inhalation, hand-to-mouth activity, and diet, EPA educates the members of the school community in many ways and on how they could reduce their total PCB exposure. And we do it working, again, as I had mentioned, in coordination with our colleagues from the New York City Department of Health and also the Department of Education and some of our clinical counterparts, the pediatric unit up at Mount Sinai. And
right.
Just very briefly, I mean, some of these methods may just seem simplistic, but they could be effective. Some things like frequent hand washing by students, teachers, and other school staff would help reduce exposures certainly to anything that might be in dust. That's obviously not going to help anyone that's inhaling things. But we also have been reaching out to the school personnel and the custodial staff on the identification and reporting of things like deteriorated cork, on the proper disposal of leaking ballast, and very importantly, on the need for proper ventilation in the school buildings.
Okay.
So we've been doing all of that. Yeah.
Okay. Doing just a little more kind of follow-up on this one particular part of this, because this is truly a large part of the purpose of our interview. Would it be reasonable for me to state then that at the current moment that there are not educational materials that specifically state, and just let me make this very clear, what I'm saying there does not exist, that there would not be educational materials that said, since you've had an exposure, an unusual excess exposure, an exposure on top of the average exposure for other people throughout the world, to these PCBs in this indoor air in these schools that have used these chemicals over a long period of time, and people have been there for years, going to school there, working there, whatever, that since you've had that much exposure and it's close to what we think is an acceptable level of exposure, then you'll be very wise to make every effort you could to minimize your exposure. It's just all common sense that you would minimize your exposure by carefully considering reducing your consumption of animal fat. Is it reasonable to say that no such message has been sent before the people that are in these schools?
I can't specifically say that I've seen something used in those specific terms. However, I do know that in various types of outreach, we have talked about the large contribution of diet. Well, again, mostly talking about PCBs, but by extension, POPs.
Right.
And I know I have spoken at schools and saying, things like dairy and animal fats, where you're going to, and certain types of fish, obviously, is where you're going to be getting your dietary PCBs from. So if it's not specifically spelled out in writing the way you articulated it, it has been, communicated in other ways, shapes, or forms.
It's there, it's in the total product.
Yes.
That's what you're saying. Let's just, let me give you one more question. Cancer Action New York, that's our organization. Our organization, the organization I work for, is a grassroots environmental group. We started in January 2000. So Cancer Action New York, this group that we started, it advocates for the creation of POPs, persistent organic pollutants, POPs, exposure minimization, educational outreach programs within governmental public health entities at all levels of government. We believe that these programs must disseminate messages, such as I just described there, that empower individuals to avoid all the unnecessary exposures of significant magnitude. The fact that POPs exposure takes place largely as a result of animal fat consumption must be presented to the audience. It is our position that POPs exposure minimization educational outreach is a very key part of minimizing the harm that will result. There will be a certain amount of harm result, and to minimize that harm, the amount that will result from POPs contamination in the global environment. Do you believe, you know, this is just you, not EPA, just you as a scientist, do you believe that this type of education that I just described would be of substantial benefit to the population that is receiving and has received these significant exposures to PCBs in the schools?
Well, as long-winded as I was in answering your first question, I'll be brief in answering your last question. And I would say, yes, I would be inclined to say that this type of educational outreach is worthwhile regardless of PCB status in schools, and even more important when PCBs in schools are an issue.
Yeah, that certainly follows the message of that WHO report, the Persistent Organic Pollutants Impact on Child Health. Well, Dr. Madeline, you are a great guy. I want to just say that in all of my interactions thus far on POPs and cancer and POPs in chronic disease with governmental employees, you know, governmental scientists, governmental regulatory administrators, various other people. You and Dr. Vincent Caliano and this Dr.
Bill
Suk,
Suk.
Dr. William Suk, you three men have been the furthest into the future and on the page, so to speak, of using the existing scientific knowledge right, you know, as it comes from the scientists, using that knowledge to minimize the amount of harm that will result after all this is said and done.
So we're still on tape, right, now that I'm getting all these accolades?
Yep, we certainly are. We're still right there in the middle of the interview.
All right. I better cut it off now and quit while I'm ahead.
Okay. Yeah, you're a great guy, and you know, I'm very happy to have made your acquaintance, and I'm never going to forget how you did. You said in the letter to me that you would help out on moving forward on the, you know, the presentation of this message, that total POPs and total minimization of exposures by making these changes in diet. You'd help out on that, and here you go. You've helped us a lot with this interview. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. John, any parting comments?
No, thanks for the opportunity.
I hope you guys have a great holiday season.
You too. Okay, bye now.
Yeah, bye. This has been Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. I have just been speaking with one of the great scientists that EPA employs, Dr. Mark Madaloni. He's a risk assessor. We've been talking about PCB exposure and persistent organic pollutant exposure and what can be done about it to minimize the amount of disease that will result from the presence of these chemicals in the environment. This has been Loving the Earth Environmental Revolution. Our program is a part of the work of Cancer Action New York and the Cancer Action News Network. Thank you for all your good listening, and I hope you have a wonderful holiday season.